It is Thursday, June 27, 2013. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 215A. Representative Springer, would you like to speak to the bill? The amendment in front of us.
And Mr. Chairman, as a committee, you should have the A7 amendment. The amendment removes the amendments to the statute from ORS 659850, which is discrimination in education statutes, and adds it to ORS 332.075, which is the powers of school district boards. It permits the school district to enter into written agreement with governing body of federally recognized Native American tribe in Oregon, located closest to school district, to identify acceptable name, symbol, or image of mascot that represents or is associated with Native American tribe. School districts shall enforce behavior expectations of students and spectators at athletic events in relation to mascot. Athletic directors or other person identified by school board shall complete cultural diversity training. There is no revenue, minimal fiscal impact on the measure, and the amendment does replace the measure.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. Just very briefly, we've had quite a bit of discussion about this bill. It's been heard on both the House Education Committee and the Senate Committee. It did pass out in the original form, House Bill 215, out of the Senate with 4 no votes. This bill is not about pictures on a football jersey. I would not have invested this much time in a bill that was about pictures on a football jersey or symbols that are in a gym floor. This bill is about districts, most of which are rural and small, or small, having the opportunity, creating the opportunity and the need for a relationship with their local tribe. This keeps in place a long-standing history in the state of recognizing tribal-to-tribal or government-to-government agreements with the tribes. Certainly, I'll answer any questions about this, but I would just reiterate, there is too much going on in this legislature for one representative, one member of it, to spend the countless hours, months that I have on this bill for pictures. This is about a district, many of which have little diversity, real diversity in their schools. It's an opportunity to build some real relationships. It's an opportunity to give tribes a say and a voice and an influence in schools like they have never had before, and I welcome that. I'll answer any questions you may
have.
Thank
you very much. Are there any questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -7 amendments to Senate Bill 215A.
Representative Weil moves the -7 amendments to Senate Bill 215A. Is there any discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Same substantial improvement over both the original bill and earlier amendments that I have seen recognizes the point of this bill, as I see it, is to empower Native American tribes in Oregon vis-a-vis their work with the school districts, and I very much appreciate the representative's comments about cultural diversity and relationships between tribes and schools.
This is the amendment.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I move
to adopt this. Any objection? Hearing none. Motion carries. Bill is amended.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 215A to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Hoyle moves Senate Bill 215A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Dembrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be a no on this. I couldn't support more the goal of promoting dialogue between school districts and Native tribes and making them aware of the cultural heritage and all that the tribes have brought to the region. But I don't think the way to do that, is necessarily to have a mascot. To be honest, I don't like the term mascot. It in and of itself, a mascot to my mind connotes a position of inferiority and otherness, and that is a problem for me. You know, this is an issue that has been before the State Board of Education in the state for many years, going back to when I was on it. And there has been a lengthy discussion. We've heard from many people, many young people, organizations representing young people, the negative psychological effect that seeing your people considered a mascot has on people. And, you know, again, I fully respect the goals here, but I just don't see, I think it's time for us to move to a different relationship between young people and Native Americans in this country. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Is there further discussion, Representative Holby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I share the sentiments expressed by Representative Dimbrough, and I will be a no on this bill.
Thank you. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do feel that this bill actually does reinforce the spirit of the tribal presence in Oregon and the value that they have contributed to our community from the founding of the state and even before, of course, that up until and including now. This includes the tribal governments and the tribal leadership in this decision in regards to mascots and schools, and that's a very, very positive step forward. And so I think we are actually advancing the cause of tribal and non-tribal relationships here in the state. So I enthusiastically support the bill.
Thank you. Further discussion? Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Dembrough.
No.
Representative Holby.
No.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Kenemer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hoyle.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Chair Garrett.
Aye. Motion carries. Bill goes to the floor. Representative Springer, will be the carrier, please. Close the work session on Senate Bill 215A. Open a work session on House Bill 3453.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3453 has been heard on June 3rd, June 17th, and again today we have a -17 amendment. On the SMS, I have parceled out the sections to correspond as we go through. So Section 2 allows the governor to determine fiscal conditions that compromise ability of county to provide minimal adequate level of public safety. Governor shall consult with Senate President, the Majority and Minority Leader, Speaker, Majority and Minority Leader of the House, each senator and representative whose district is wholly or partially within county. Section 3, after obtaining written authorization signed by governing body of each county subject to proclamation, governor may enter into intergovernmental agreement with other local governments for performance of functions and activities related to public safety. Cost of public safety services provided under the IGA will be shared between state and county parties subject to IGA. State will be responsible for 50% of costs, and effective counties will bear 50% of cost, which may be funded through income tax or other alternative means of assessment. Counties may impose surtax on state personal, corporate, income tax, or excise tax, tax on telecommunication services with access to 911 emergency reporting system. Any assessment county governing body is lawfully capable of imposing to the extent necessary to satisfy county's funding obligations, or existing sources of county revenue, or any combination of the previously mentioned revenue sources. The Section 4 specifies the content of the IGA. Section 5 states that the unit of local government designated in IGA to perform functions or activity is vested with all powers, rights, and duties relating to those functions and activities that are vested by law in each party to the agreement and its officers and agencies. Officers designated in IGA to perform duties of two or more public officers shall be considered to hold one office. Section 6, the intergovernmental entity created by IGA may adopt rules necessary to carry out IGA, specifies process for division, disposition, and distribution of any assets, debt, or liabilities created by entity under the IGA. Section 7 specifies type of income tax eligible to the county to fund 50% of shared responsibility as previously described in Section 3. Section 8, 8A, and 8B allow counties covered by proclamation to tax on retail subscriber with access to 911 telecommunication. Governor may not authorize 911 tax. Section 9, public safety fiscal emergency proclamation terminates after 18 months unless governor extends declaration for up to 18 more months. Governor shall terminate public safety fiscal emergency by proclamation when emergency no longer exists or a threat of emergency has passed. Public safety fiscal emergency proclaimed by governor may be terminated any time by action of legislative assembly. Termination of public safety fiscal emergency shall apply to income and excise tax years beginning on or after January 1 following the termination and other assessment reporting requirement periods beginning on or after first day of first calendar quarter following termination. Section 10 is a statement of public safety fiscal emergency as it is a matter of state concern. Sections 11 through 14 sunset the provisions of this act January 2nd, 2018. There is an emergency clause on the measure. We do not have a fiscal or a revenue on the 17s. We did receive one on the dash 15s, which is only slightly different than the 17s before you today. It had an indeterminate fiscal and needs to be heard by the Ways and Means Committee. So today we will be asking to refer it down to Ways and Means without the fiscal and or revenue statement at this point. Representative Hicks has been working on this amendment, so please correct me if I missed anything, sir.
Thank you very much, Aaron. And yes, I'd like Representative Hicks to sort of take that volume of information we just received and distill it into what we should be aware of.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Chair. What the bill does, and I do, I just want to actually preface all this by saying I've been working very, very closely with the governor's office, with representatives from Oregon's counties here, and this is, in my mind, an excellent collaborative effort, the product of a collaborative effort. So what it does is it says this. It says the governor may identify counties that are in a status of public safety distress, and upon that identification, he will go to a certain listed set of legislators and consult with them as to what a good plan should be. After that, he would declare a state of public safety emergency regarding a county or counties, and he could then approach the governing body of the county that's affected and ask for an express written agreement which would create an intergovernmental relationship. Without the express written agreement of the governing body of the county, there will be the process will go no further. If the governing body of the county and the governor reach terms of an agreement that they can both find acceptable, then the two will jointly, on a 50-50 basis, fund portions or all of the justice, the county level justice system, from a variety of available sources that would be permitted by either the charter, if it's a county charter, or the statutes that control counties. The available sources could be, for instance, a non-charter county, could be as listed an income tax. If the governing body consents to it, the governor may not impose an income tax or any other assessment or tax without consent of the governing body of the county or the commissioners. But if the commissioners agree to it, then the governor can, and the governor and the commissioners can put in an income tax. They can put in a 911 surcharge if they find that to be appropriate, or any other measure that the governing body, the commissioner, and the governor find to be appropriate. Certain counties in Oregon, charter counties such as my own and Josephine, have expressed provisions that explicitly prohibit income tax, and so that kind of thing would not be permitted. But those counties are in the law allowed to, the governing bodies, the commissioners in those counties can, it just the law articulates that they can create any form of assessment that they would be otherwise permitted to do. So there's no change there. And then they will remain in this relationship for 18 months. It can be renewed at the 18-month period for an additional 18 months upon certain provisions. The governor would need to go through the consulting process again, for example. And then that's it. And the bill sunsets on January 1st, 2018. And that's about the size of it.
Thank you very much, not only for the explanation, but for your work with the governor's office and others to get this ready. I'd like to have a motion that we can have discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash 17 amendments to House Bill 3453.
Representative Hoyle moves the dash 17 amendments to House Bill 3453. Is there a discussion? Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you. I want to get on the record a couple of things just to make certain I understand. I'm looking at these sections on taxation. I don't think there's any preemption in state law now on an income tax in the county. And the way this is drafted, it appears to me as though the things that are exempt under state law from taxation would continue to be exempt for income tax purposes, the way this is drafted. But I'm concerned about Section 8, which talks about telecommunications taxes, the 911 tax, I think, if I read this correctly. My recollection, and I may be wrong, but my recollection is that 911 taxes are preempted by the state from counties, and I assume that the purpose of this language would be to set that preemption in abeyance for the purpose of this emergency. Is that the understanding of the committee administrator or the drafter or the or Representative Hicks?
I think Representative Hicks can speak to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, so as to first Section 7 regarding the income tax, we did contemplate removing the language entirely, but the consequence of that would have been that each county would then have been free to come up with its own income tax code, basically. The state exemptions and provisions, the county wouldn't necessarily be tracking them. And so without the language in the bill regarding an income tax, I mean, the county can do such a thing, but with the language in the bill regarding the income tax, and this is only, again, for the counties to which the income tax would apply, Josephine is not one of them, this language basically says that they may track the Oregon income tax code.
Basically piggyback with a surtax.
Correct.
Okay. How about the other piece?
As for the 911, yes, my take on it is, I think, this is a 911 statute, this is a statutory exemption from the preemption. And that's what it is. The county governing authority the county governing body has the authority under this bill, the statutory authority, to impose an
IMO. If I may, Mr. Chair, as I understand it, this is essentially a carve out from the normal rule, and that's mm-hmm. fine. I just wanted to make sure it was on the record that that's what it is.
Okay. Do we have further discussion on the motion? Let's call the roll, please.
This is the amendment. The motion right? is on the amendment.
I know. Did you not want to? Okay. Is there any objection to the amendment? Hearing none, motion carries. The bill is amended. Chair moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on House Bill 3453 without having the fiscal impact and revenue impact statements on hand at this time. Again, this will be for the purpose of setting the bill to Ways and Means, not to the floor.
Okay.
The motion is undebatable. Is there any objection? Hearing none, motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3453 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendations and the measure be referred to a committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Hoyle moves that House Bill 3453 be as amended. Let me start over. Vice Chair Hoyle moves House Bill 3453 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the measure be referred to committee on Ways and Means. Is there discussion? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to put on the record that I had a lot of heartache over this. Some of these powers in here seem, although the bill has substantially improved from the last time I looked at it, and I appreciate the hard work that Representative Hicks has put to it, I am still deeply troubled by some of the precedents set in here. That being said, I will give this a courtesy yes vote to Ways and Means, but reserve my right, should it come out of Ways and Means, to perhaps have a contrary opinion on the floor.
Okay, thank you very much. Further discussion? Representative Kenner?
I guess I'd be willing to do a courtesy vote as well. I have some serious concerns about some of the powers granted to the governor, among other things.
Okay. Let's call the roll, please.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Dembro?
Aye.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Penemar?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hoyle?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Chair Garrett?
Aye. Motion carries. The bill is referred to Ways and Means. Close the work session on House Bill 3453. Open a work session on House Bill 3267.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I will jump to what the amendment does. You have a dash A3 amendment, which replaces the original measure and authorizes governing body of Maher County on or before December 31st, 2020 to accept application to plan and zone site outside of urban growth boundary for industrial use after reviewing certain data that at least 20% of the county residents had income in preceding 12 months below poverty level and notwithstanding land use planning goals related to urbanization and public facilities and services. It authorizes the governing body to approve application if they determine applicant has committed to provide at least 50 new permanent jobs, water, sanitary, sewer service, and electricity are available, and consider recommendation of Business Development Department and Land Conservation and Development Department that there is not adequate available site for proposed industrial use outside UGB and plan zoned to allow industrial use or within UGB, requires governing body to plan and zone approved application for industrial use at least 15 years after approval. There's no revenue, minimal fiscal on the dash A3 amendment. And Representative Benz.
Representative Benz, would you like to tell us what this is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cliff Benz, District 60. Thank you very much for hearing this bill. Colleagues, many of you know that Malheur County is a county of 6.3 million acres located immediately adjacent to the state of Idaho. We enjoy about 275 of those 6.3 million acres are zoned industrial. Of those 275 acres, there are numerous parcels within them. So I believe the largest single parcel we have is 75 acres. Those acres happen to be located within the urban growth boundary, and 200 of those 275 acres of available land were just changed to industrial about 6 months ago. We, over the years, and I've spent 36 years in that county, we have had opportunities fleeting for industrial activity, almost all of it requiring much larger parcels. And this is because, as most of you know, the county is immediately adjacent to Idaho, and Idaho's land use planning laws are, shall we say, a bit more liberal than Oregon's. That would be the understatement of the session. I would say that this bill gives the county court basically 6 years, because as you can see, there's a sunset, December 31st of 2020, to suggest to folks who happen by that we could respond and have industrial land rapidly if it meets the criteria set forth in this bill. There are a number of protections in this bill for our current land use planning system. For example, this won't be allowed to happen if we already have industrial land zone that is available, because we wouldn't need it. You should also note that there has to be a 20% poverty rate in the county. Currently, Malheur County's poverty rate is 39%. So we easily meet that requirement. There's another protection contained in the dash 3 amendments at the end and on paragraph 3, that if we approved an application, the county shall plan and zone the approved site for industrial use for at least 15 years. So we couldn't zone it industrial and then down zone it for houses. I'll just share with you that that would be highly unlikely because there's very little demand in Malheur County for houses, which is another story entirely. colleagues, the situation is this. We have just several things in Malheur County. We have a lot of space, 6.3 million acres in that county alone. We also have some extremely hopeful people, and this would help dramatically in giving folks something to point at that others don't have, which is the chance to situate a very large business fairly quickly. What's happened in the past is that those who've come to Malheur County either leave because we haven't had a large enough parcel or go to Idaho, and this would give us a chance to compete somewhat with them. The last thing I will mention is that the other protections we have in here are that the applicant has to commit to provide at least 50 new permanent jobs, and there has to be water, sanitary, sewer service, and electricity available to the site. We have all that. And we have some other challenges that are facing us that have to do with the fact that Ontario could be losing up to 700 jobs in the very near future because the hospital that is situated in the center of downtown Ontario is now going to have competition 100 yards into Idaho from Ontario from a brand new $80 million facility. And so the intent of the folks on the other side of the river is to draw that business out of my county and into Idaho. How are we going to replace those 700 jobs? How? I don't know. But what I would like to be able to do is utilize what we do have, which is a lot of space. The last thing I want to mention is this. We have a very narrow area there where the railroad runs through, and there is water, and we have people, we have infrastructure. Many people would become upset if we suggested that we were going to bring an industry in and place it on agricultural land. In my county, it's not the land, it's the water. We can move the water. So if someone comes in with a large facility, maybe they want 1,000 acres and we place a facility on it, we will pick the water up and move it to another 1,000 acres. As I said, we have 6.3 million acres of space. We have about 200,000 acres of irrigated ground. So lots of dry ground. I would very much appreciate your support on this bill.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Representative Berger?
No question, just a comment. Representative Bentz, the delivery of your description is wry and at times amusing, and so it causes me and others here to smile. But the seriousness of the situation you described for the people who live there can't be overstated. And I just want to emphasize that I get it. This really matters to a great big piece of land in our state that you're responsible for and we're all responsible for. Thank you for bringing this bill.
Thank you. Thank you for those remarks. I shouldn't be, as you say, so glib about it because it is
well,
serious.
Well, you know your delivery is.
Representative Demmer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I do have a few questions, Representative. So the 20% poverty level, where did that come from? What is the current poverty level in Malheur County?
39%.
So why 20%?
What the concern was, I think, in putting this standard in, is that we didn't want the land use planning folks to think that we were circumventing the 40 years of effort to make the system work for no good reason. And so what I'm trying to show here is that we have fleeting opportunities for growth. You have to be ready when people come through, and we're not. Our system is backwards. It assumes demand. We don't have demand. We don't have time to wait. But on the other hand, I understand the value of our system and our land use planning system. I understand the expectations that have been built up. I understand there have to be good reasons to not follow every step and all the time that it takes. So the urgency is the poverty rate. And the thought here is, we easily exceed that. But that was the reason it's in the bill.
Mm-hmm. Could just follow up. I'm just wondering why you didn't use, like, the statewide average, which, to be honest, I don't know what the statewide average poverty rate is.
I don't either. I picked about half what ours is. Okay. That's how much detail went into it.
Okay. Another question. Just your statement that this would only happen if industrial land isn't available. I don't know if I heard you correctly. That's not actually in the bill. That's the assumption is that people would use existing industrial land if it were available and would only be interested in this if it weren't. But there's no requirement in the bill, is there, for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dimbro, if you'll look on page 2 of the dash A3's lines 2 through 5, the governing body may approve an application if the governing body determines that, taking into consideration recommendations of the Oregon Business Development Department and DLCD, there is not an adequate available site for the proposed industrial use that is located outside of an acknowledged boundary or within the urban growth boundary. The theory is that if we don't have the space already available, then we could use this tool.
So if I could follow up, because I find the wording kind of unclear here. Taking into consideration the recommendations of the Oregon Business Development Department and the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Does that mean, the assumption is that they will be recommending, that, you know, they will be saying that there's not enough land? What would those recommendations be?
The intent is that we would use this tool if we didn't have available land. I want to mention one thing that we have that's a huge challenge to us. If you have one parcel of 75 acres and someone arrives that wants to buy it, the owners will quickly raise the price because there's no competition. And so for years, that's what's happened. And we've not been able to have three or four parcels so some willing buyer could come in and keep the price fair. So my hope is that this would operate to keep those prices down, and we might actually have someone able to buy one of these parcels. That's the idea.
Okay. And just finally, there's a requirement of 50 jobs would be available. Is there any, what happens if those jobs actually don't come about, or if they're sort of minimum wage jobs, or are there you know, sideboards about the quality of the jobs or the duration of the jobs, or whatever. I know you have some assumptions, but what do you imagine happening?
Well, what I hope happens is that we actually have someone show up that hires somebody, and we actually have something happen. Nothing has happened for years, and we're losing 700 jobs. So the honest-to-God truth of it is, any job. I remember the judge over in Burns said when he ran for the job initially, he wanted clean, moral, upstanding, high-paying jobs. Now, after 10 years, he just wants jobs. After 36 years, I just want jobs. And that is
sorry, that's not funny.
That's not funny. That's not funny.
Yeah. Anyway, we don't have too many sideboards except jobs.
Thank you, Representative.
One last thing, if I may. Idaho's minimum wage is $2 an hour less than Oregon's. Any job in Oregon is better than Idaho.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jones, I appreciate you bringing this forward, going through and looking at all the standards that are in this. Might this, in the future, if the legislature decides, might these standards fit some other counties that perhaps in eastern Oregon that have similar scenarios?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holy, they may. We can view this, and I kind of did, as a trial. That's why we have a sunset in it. Malheur County has the, I don't want to call it an advantage, but it's right next to Idaho. It borders Idaho for hundreds of miles, and my other counties don't. But nonetheless, and also Malheur County has another benefit. It has the railroad. It has the freeway. And I've already asked Baker County, which is in my district, if they wanted more industrial land. They have said, no, they're fine. But we have huge opportunity. We're only 45 miles from 600,000 people. We're actually 100 yards from 600,000 people. That's the Boise Valley. The furthest point away from the border of Malheur County and the other side of Treasure Valley is 43 miles. So we're right on the edge of a whole bunch of folks. So it's different. There's opportunity I think we haven't been taking advantage of because we couldn't move quickly enough. That's my hope. But to answer your question more shortly, maybe.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much, Representative. We appreciate I certainly appreciate you bringing this bill. I'm an enthusiastic supporter of it, and hope we have more opportunities to do what we can to help your community and your part of the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's deeply appreciated.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -3 amendments to House Bill 3267.
Representative Hoyle moves the -A3 amendments to House Bill 3267. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3267 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hoyle moves House Bill 3267 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Representative Dembrough.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to be a no on this today. I need to think about it a little more before it comes to the floor, but for now, that's my vote.
Appreciate that. Any other discussion? Let's call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Dembrough?
No.
Representative Holdy?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Kenimer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hoyle?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Chair Garrett?
Aye. Motion carries. Bill moves to the floor. Representative Bensel will be the carrier. Close the work session on House Bill 3267. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3528.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3528 was previously before you on May 20th and May 29th, and you have before you a -2 amendment. The -2 amendment exempts registered lobbyists from reporting to Oregon Government Ethics Commission money spent on lobbying another registered lobbyist. The exemption does not apply if person lobbied is legislative official, executive official, or member of state board or commission. The exemption sunsets on June 30th, 2015. There is an emergency clause on the amendment.
I don't know that we need them to. Colleagues, as you heard, there's a sunset in this bill. I'm supportive of this approach, which provides a couple years for what everybody understood the status quo to be to continue while we enable a more complete discussion than the session can permit about how we actually fix the statute for the long term. So it works for me. I hope it works for you, and I'd like to move the bill. So.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -2 amendments to House Bill 3528.
Representative Hoyle moves the -2 amendments to House Bill 3528. Is there any discussion? Representative Kenimer?
Yeah, I'm afraid I hadn't had a chance to look at this. I guess my issue, and I think it's covered, is that we have a number of government agencies who have members who are registered as lobbyists, and this does not exempt them. And also, in the event that they are lobbied by other lobbyists, that they're not exempt from reporting.
It was my understanding that the bill had been amended previously to ensure that government representatives who are lobbied by private sector lobbyists, in that scenario, reporting continues. But I'm going to ask Mr. Cosgrove and Marla to come confirm that, please, so we don't do something inadvertent.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for your record, Marla Ray with the Capital Club. They would, if an agency legislative advocate is a registered lobbyist and I were to lobby that person, those expenses are being reported, will be reported, because that person's an executive official, and that's clarified in that statute.
Thank you.
Was that in an amendment that we adopted previously, or is that already in existing law?
That's in this, in the -2s.
It is in the -2s. Okay.
Yeah. So that's how you read that. Thank you.
Yes.
Adopt the -2s.
Okay. Is there further discussion with Representative Hicks?
No.
Okay.
No.
Good job, Paul.
That was my favorite testimony of Mr. Cosgrove's yet.
Okay, we have a motion on the table to adopt the -2 amendments to House Bill 3528. Is there further discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none, motion carries. The bill is amended.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3528 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hoyle moves House Bill 3528 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none, motion carries. I will carry the bill. Close the work session on House Bill 3528. Open a work session on Senate Bill 789.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 789 limits total period of time school district or educational service district is subject to actuarial analysis to 6 years when district provides health benefit plans other than those provided by Oregon Educators Benefits Board. Clarifies requirement that actuarial analysis does not apply to certain self-insured districts, districts with independent health insurance trusts, or community college districts. Removes a certain requirement actuarial analysis be performed at least once every 2 years. This measure comes to you from the Senate floor with 25 aye votes, 4 noes, and 1 member was excused. There is no revenue and minimal fiscal impact on the measure.
We don't have a sign-up sheet, but you can ask if anybody wants to come up and speak.
Who is it? Mr. Rose, do you want to speak to this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ozzie Rose, and I represent the Beaver School District. There are half a dozen or so school...
Mr. Black's going to join you.
Okay. We did this yesterday, and it didn't work real well.
Do better.
There are half a dozen or so districts that when the OEBB was set up, were given an exemption because their program they had provided health benefits at a lower cost and an equal value. They've had to, every year, have that analyzed again. And this bill will change it so that they only have to be analyzed if the board asks them or if their local teachers unit or other labor unit asks them.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, for the record, Justin Black from the Oregon Education Association. This is a great working relationship with representatives from Beaverton School District and Senator Haas. You know, our view is there's a lot of data out there that shows OEB is saving the state about $50 million a year right now in administrative costs. Every district had the chance up front to go to OEB and say, we are actually saving money with our benefit package. And if they were able to prove that, they were able to stay out. So what we have now is we have about 10 or 11 districts that are outside of OEB that have been proving that they are doing a good job with their benefits and can offer a similar benefit plan at a less expensive cost than OEB. Every other district had that chance. We're not necessarily able to meet that criteria. What this basically does is get rid of the requirement that they do it every other year now and only do it when either the district or the employee group requests that the actuary analysis be done.
Any questions for either? Okay, thank you both for the explanation.
One question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Representative Holby.
So you mentioned that the plans themselves are similar. They're not exactly the same, but, you know, how similar are they, I guess, you know?
Comparable.
Just sort of curious.
Sure. Rep. Holby, Rip Garrett, members of the committee. So there's a requirement in the when districts are matching up with OEB that OEB has to have a similar plan to the district. So if a district has a super, super rich plan that OEB can't meet, they stop the test right there and the district stays out. But the onus right now is that OEB have an actuarially equivalent plan, and they define that as within 2% of value. And if OEB has a plan that matches up to the district, then it goes down to if the district is offering it at a lower cost, then the district would stay out.
So to clarify,
further question.
So the district that's opting out has to have it within 2% of the same value of the OEB plan?
No, Rep. Holy, Rep. Garrett, members of the chair committee, whatever. Sorry.
It's okay, sanitize.
It's almost that percent, you guys. Move on.
No, the onus is actually on OEB to have the equivalent value. So a district like Bethel has a really, really rich plan, and OEB, I think at the last test, didn't have an equivalent plan to offer. So I think they just kind of stopped the test right there, and Bethel was able to stay out. So that's the onus is on OEB to have the equivalent plan. And then if they do, then it's the onus is on the district to have to offer it at a lower cost.
Okay. Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you. I have two questions. If this bill passes, how will you know whether the condition still applies?
Rep. Barnhart, members of the committee, it'll lie on us. We're going to do some of that work to inform our members of, you know, if the plans look like they match up visually and the plan at OEB is less cost, our employees will ask for the actuarial analysis.
A second question. How much does one of these analyses that you now have to do cost?
Rep. Barnhart, Chair Garrett.
And
right
who
now,
pays it?
Right now, OEB pays it. So there are some districts that have gone ahead and done the analysis before they go to OEB, and I think the cost has ranged from $1,000 to more than that. But the requirement is that OEB does the analysis. Districts are required to provide number of subscribers to each plan, benefit design, and something else, and cost of plan. But that's right now all they're required to. Districts have taken the initiative to do the analysis a lot of times before they even interact with OEB, so they know where they stand before they go through the process.
It turns out I have one more question, if I may. If neither the district nor the employees ask for an analysis in the future, if this bill passes, there won't ever be one again. Is that right?
Correct.
Thank you.
Further questions? All right, thank you both.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 789 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Hoyle moves Senate Bill 789 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, motion carries. Representative Reed will carry the bill. Close the work session on Senate Bill 789. Open a work session on SJR1.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SJR1 was heard yesterday afternoon. The measure proposes amendment to Oregon Constitution to finance Corpus of Oregon Student Opportunity Fund, allows use of monies for lawful purpose if emergency is declared by governor, and use is approved by 4/5 of Legislative Assembly members present in each house, and if Legislative Assembly has approved plan to replenish fund on appropriate terms. Refers proposed constitutional amendment to people for approval or rejection at next general election. There is no revenue impact. The fiscal impact was issued. And we have no amendment today.
Okay. We are ready.
Mr. Chair, I move SJR1 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Representative Hoyle moves SJR1 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I believe that SJR1 at its core is a really good idea. But it is a really good idea that needs a lot of discussion, a lot of vetting, and a lot of sideboards, none of which are going with it through this session. And so, I mean, I hate to rain on a really good idea, but if the voters come back and approve this, I don't know what they're approving. And I'm not at this time prepared. I would, if I had my choice, I would spend an interim getting all this right and then bring it to the voters. But as currently constituted, I'm sorry, I can't say yes.
Understood. Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yesterday I was in doubt, but as I looked at the proposal, I realized that all this does is give the authority to the legislature to go beyond the $50,000 debt limitation contained in the Constitution for yet one more purpose, and in this case having to do with the Oregon Student Opportunity Fund. It doesn't require the legislature to put any money in the fund or to use the fund. In fact, we have some funds in Article 11 now that have never been used. They're in the Constitution, but nobody's ever used them. I would expect this one will get used, but when the legislature considers actually committing money to the fund, that's the point at which I expect the sideboards and the very careful analysis and the bond council and the various undertakings that have to be entered into with the fine-tooth comb is actually done. This is really requesting the people to give us permission to go ahead and do that. And then that, for that reason, I'll be a yes.
I have the same kind of question that Representative Berger did, and ultimately I'm comfortable for the reasons you just said. So, Representative Dembrough?
Representative Barnhart said much of what I was going to say. I just think it's it's time for us to ask the people of Oregon whether they're prepared to use bonding to invest not only in physical infrastructure but in human infrastructure, which, you know, we all certainly, you know, we love physical infrastructure, physical capital projects because of the jobs that they create, you know, to build those buildings. Well, I would argue that the return on investment that we will get from this program, potentially, if it's done right, the sideboards are all there, et cetera, will be at least as large for this state in terms of creating the increasing the earning capacity of Oregonians and getting them to getting their skills built to the level that they can really help build this state.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. I do concur with Representative Berger. She said it very succinctly. Excellent idea. The enabling legislation would have been what would have allowed me to very enthusiastically support this. I agree with Representative Dembro wholeheartedly on the concept and would merely add that a better educated workforce makes us more appealable to employers, businesses, and the like, by all accounts. And so you're right, we probably will see a payoff in our overall economy over time. But there are questions that for instance, we don't know yet, and without the enabling legislation, we don't really have a good sense of whether this really would obligate the legislature for 12 to 15 years of general fund debt service liability. Maybe not, but I don't know, maybe. That's something that I would want to know or have a better sense of. We don't know who's going to be, we know who's going to be handling the investments, but we don't know what will happen to the earnings thereafter, really. It's a wide open question right now. So I have confidence in the treasurer to handle the investments well, and confidence in the people to make a good decision in regards to what we're about to send them, the question we're about to send them, apparently. But today, I don't feel that it's ready to go out.
Sam Holby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with everybody. So I have struggled with this a little bit. On the one hand, I'm very supportive of the concept and the idea, but I also worry about the competition with our bonding capacity, and the way our bonding capacity has been traditionally used creates immediate direct jobs, which are income and income tax revenues, as opposed to investing in, you know, opportunity grants and things for education, which are extremely important, don't get me wrong, and a great idea. But it, you know, it's that aspect of it that troubles me a little bit. But I think long term it could be a very viable fund. And the fact that we're able to put other types of monies into it, not just bonding, and they're able to have other sources, and it's up to the future legislature to decide what amount of bonding, if any, they're going to put into this fund, gives me a little bit of comfort, but not, you know, a huge amount, but a little bit. So, you know, I'm trying to wrap up my thoughts on this, but you know, I'm going to be a yes on this, but I'm going to keep thinking about it and may end up being a no on the floor. I am just still a little bit concerned about how all this comes together and what its overall impact. If we look at what the revenue impact will be to us if for every dollar that we take out of capital construction and put it into education, you know, those are immediate income jobs, mm-hmm. you know, versus the future workforce, which is important too. So, torn on it. Think it's a great idea. I'm going to be a yes right now, but still thinking, because I agree with everybody.
Representative Jensen?
I don't know that I agree with anybody.
Usually we're up to the whole.
No, seriously. The This sounds remarkably like a proposal, maybe not quite as grandiose as we heard a few years ago from the now departed compliments of one-way ticket being bought, I guess, for the president of the University of Oregon. Am I wrong in this?
You're exactly right.
We do this. We create an entity of some sort, right? I mean, is it possible? Are we looking at donations, private donations, estate donations, et cetera, et cetera, sort of thing that might fuel this source of money by a substantial amount, thus increasing the something that might be hard to do without a vehicle of this type. I don't like the idea, and I'm reminded of one of my favorite quotes from Einstein, and that is, no problem can be solved with the same thinking that created it. And this kind of gets us a little bit out of the thinking that we've had as to how to fund and finance and help young people and older people too, you know, through the university or through a higher education, whether it's a university or whether it's a trade type of school. I would hope it wouldn't be, you know, confined there. So I'm going to be a yes with, yeah, some guarded optimism, but I like the idea.
Mr. Chair, can I just say one thing? Actually, Representative Jensen followed my train of my train of thought was following the same as yours, because I too was thinking about that U of O bonding proposal, and I've talked to the Treasurer about that, about the notion of could this be married with philanthropy. One of the real problems that I had with the University of Oregon bonding proposal was that it was just for the University of Oregon. And what really attracts me to this notion is it's for students everywhere in this state, no matter which school they go to. And, you know, there might be some nervousness actually at the University of Oregon over this, because people might be tempted to donate to this statewide fund, you know, as opposed to their own alma mater or whatever, and that's understandable. But I think that it really is laudable, I think, to be thinking about the students of the state as a whole, community college, university, people who are doing, you know, high-level transfer kinds of, you know, collegiate courses, and those who are doing professional technical.
Representative Jensen?
My thought on this is, given the news that we got yesterday that the university is not being severely penalized by the NC2A, I think they're happy enough with the world as if, that they'd be delighted with what anything that takes place. So,
I'm sorry.
All right, I think we're ready for a vote. Let's. Have we made the motion?
We have.
Let's call the roll, please.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
No.
Representative Dembro.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Penimer.
No.
Vice Chair Hoyle.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hicks.
No.
Chair Garrett.
Aye. Motion carries. Resolution moves to the floor, and Representative Reed will carry it.
That's me.
Oh, well, we have a vote change before we leave.
Okay. Chair Garrett, I request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow Representative Kennemer to change his vote on House Bill 3453. It will not change the outcome.
I think first I forgot to close the work session at 01, so Vice Chair Hoyle has moved that the rules be suspended, requesting unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow Representative Kenemer to change his vote on House Bill 3453, which was moved to Ways and Means. It will not change the outcome. Is there any objection? Hearing none. Representative Kenemer, how would you like to vote?
No, please.
Kenemer votes
Thank
no.
You.
Close the work session. Well, we didn't really go back. Committee's adjourned. Have a great evening.